Welcome to the Rapid Learning audio tutorial on limits. In this tutorial, we will cover four general topics: the meaning of the limit of a function, how to approximate limits numerically, how to find a limit using algebra, and how to find limits of functions with vertical asymptotes and removable discontinuities. Once you have finished this tutorial, you will have a firm foundation in the study of limits. This tutorial includes new material on limits in general, including a special limit called the derivative to find the slope of a tangent line to a function. Previously learned material includes algebra skills such as factoring, plugging values into functions, simplifying expressions, and finding zeros that you will use to solve limit problems. So what is a limit? In this section, we will study the meaning and uses of a mathematical limit. You will express limits verbally. You will understand limit notation. You will understand what limits mean. And most importantly, you will understand three common applications of limits. If x is the independent variable and y is the dependent variable or output of a function, then the limit of the function, as x approaches a, is the output the function seems like it will reach as the independent variable gets closer and closer to the number a. In other words, as x approaches the number a, what does the function of x do? The limit of the function is the answer to this question. Notation is an important part of the language of mathematics. It is a common frame of reference that will enhance your understanding of and your ability to apply mathematics. The notation for the limit of the function of x as x approaches a is as follows. First, you write LIM, which is an abbreviation for limit. To the right of LIM, you write f parentheses x as an abbreviation for function of x. Below LIM, you write x. Then draw an arrow pointing to the letter a. This is the abbreviation for x approaches a. So instead of writing the limit of the function of x as x approaches a, we only write this notation. Another benefit of this notation is that using it takes less time and less space, and it is easier to read quickly. Now that you have seen the form of a limit notation, let's try reading it. How would you read this limit? Lim, parentheses, t squared plus 4t minus 1, x pointing to negative 7. You may pause this recording to think about it. This limit is read, the limit of t squared plus 4t minus 1 as t approaches negative 7. While it is important to know how to read limit notation, it is just as important to understand the meaning of the limit you just read. Now that you have seen limit notation and how to read it, let's move on to the meaning of the limit notation. What does the limit of t squared plus 4t minus 1 as t approaches negative 7 mean to you? Try to recall the definition of a limit. It means, as the independent variable, t, gets closer and closer to negative 7, what value does the function t squared plus 4t minus 1 seem to be approaching? The limit is the answer to this question. Think of the limit of a function as the behavior of the function when the independent variable of the function is very close to a particular number, in this case, negative 7. This is the moment when students often ask, "Why am I learning about this topic?" When learning a mathematical concept like limits, it is often very helpful to study applications of the concept to enhance your learning, and of course, to answer the often asked question, why? To accomplish these objectives, we introduce three common applications of limits in mathematics. First, how limits are used to find the area of irregular shapes using the method of exhaustion, which will be explained. Then, how limits are used to determine instantaneous velocity using the different quotient, and a special limit called the derivative. Finally, how limits are used in computing sums of infinite series. Reviewing these three applications will provide a glimpse into the limit as a powerful mathematical tool. Areas of irregular shapes. As far back as the ancient Greeks, mathematicians have used the idea of limits to find the area of irregular shapes like a circle. Their approach is called the method of exhaustion because they systematically reduce or exhaust the error in their estimate for the circle's area, eventually arriving at the exact answer. Let's see how the concept of the limit is used in this method. Start with a circle. Any size will do. Inscribe a three-sided regular polygon, more commonly known as an equilateral triangle, in the circle. Note, a regular polygon has equal sides and equal angles. At this point, you should have a circle with an equilateral triangle drawn so that all three corners are touching the edge of the circle. The next step is sort of tricky. You bisect each of the three sides by drawing a line from the opposite corner to the middle of the side. All three lines intersect at the middle of the triangle, and the triangle is divided into six identical right triangles. So you can say the area of the equilateral triangle is the same as the sum of the area of the six identical right triangles. Since the area of any right triangle is 1/2 times base times height, the area of the equilateral triangle is the same as 6 times the area of the right triangle. Essentially, you have just estimated the area of the circle by inscribing the equilateral triangle and calculating its area. Notice that there is some of the circle that is not included in the triangle. This is the error of your estimate. You want to reduce the error by inscribing a shape that takes up more of the circle's area and that you can easily calculate its area. So how do you make a better estimate? If you said, inscribe a square, which is a four-sided regular polygon, you are correct. Bisect the corners and sides of the square by drawing lines between opposite corners and opposite side midpoints, a total of 4 lines. This divides the square into 8 identical right triangles, so the area of the square is the same as 8 times the area of the right triangle. It should appear that more of the circle is included in the square, so the estimate is better. If you continue to add sides to the inscribed shape inside the circle, the shape looks more and more like a circle because the difference between the area of the inscribed shape and the circle decreases. This is the method of exhaustion. Also, the area of the inscribed shape equals 2 times the number of sides of the inscribed shape times the area of the right triangle. With 3 sides, the area is 6 times the area of the right triangle. With 4 sides, the area is 8 times the area of the right triangle. The equation can be generalized for an inscribed regular polygon with n sides as area equals 2 times n times the area of the right triangle, which simplifies to n times b times h, where b is the base and h is the height of the right triangle. Now, for the application of the limit. As the number of sides, n, approaches infinity, which means the number of sides increases without end, the polygon approaches the shape of a circle, and the area of the polygon approaches the area of the circle. Therefore, the area of the circle can be written as the limit of n times b times h as n approaches infinity. You might be saying, hey, that isn't the formula of a circle's area that I know. Well, using trigonometry, this limit simplifies to pi r squared, the formula for the area of a circle. The limit is the key to evaluating the function n times b times h as the number of sides gets infinitely large. This unique quality of the limit enables us to move from rough estimates for the area of a circle to the exact area itself. Now, let's use limits to determine instantaneous velocity. But first, it is important to review these definitions. Velocity is the rate and direction of an object's change in position with respect to time. Average velocity is the change in an object's position divided by the amount of time that has elapsed. This ratio is known as a difference quotient. Instantaneous velocity is the velocity of an object at one exact instant, measured with a limit called the derivative. To find the instantaneous velocity of an object, find the limit of the average velocity of the object as the interval of elapsed time approaches zero. Let f of t be a function that represents the position of an object at any time t, and let h be an interval of elapsed time, that is, end time minus start time. Since a picture is often worth a thousand words, let's paint a picture to demonstrate how the limit of the average velocity is instantaneous velocity. Recall that average velocity is evaluated on an interval of elapsed time. As that interval shrinks to zero, the limit of the average velocity on the interval converges at instantaneous velocity for a specific instant in time. Graphically, the position of an object at the start and end of an interval of time is represented by two points on the graph of the function. The average velocity is the slope of the line drawn between the interval endpoints. The formula for this slope simplifies to f of t plus h minus f of t all over h. To see how the average velocity changes as the time interval gets smaller, let the elapsed time h get smaller and smaller, redrawing the line each time. As h decreases, let the end time move left toward the start time. As h gets smaller and smaller, we are observing the limit of average velocity as h approaches zero. Notice the final line intersects f of t at the start time, which is just a specific instant in time. And at that point, the slope of the line equals the slope of the curve. So we say the line is tangent to f of t at that point. The slope of the tangent line is the instantaneous velocity of the object at that specific instant in time. The average velocity cannot be evaluated when h equals zero, because h is in the denominator of the equation for average velocity. The average velocity cannot be evaluated when h equals zero, because h is in the denominator of the equation. But the limit as h approaches zero can be evaluated. This limit, which gives us a formula for the instantaneous velocity of an object at a specific instant in time, is called the derivative of a function. Before presenting how limits are used with infinite series, let's review a few more definitions. An infinite sequence is an unending list of numbers or other mathematical objects called the terms of the sequence. The list, 1, 2, 3, and so on, is a sequence where you add 1 to get the next number. Also, the list 2, 4, 8, 16, and so on, is another sequence where you multiply by 2 to get the next number. An infinite series is the sum of an unending sequence of terms. You simply add up all the terms of an unending sequence. but it isn't as easy as it sounds. A convergent infinite series is an infinite series that adds up to a finite number. It converges. Do you see how limits might be used in finding the sum of an unending sequence of numbers? Let's find out. The ancient Greek philosopher Zeno identified a paradox in the claim, "That which is in locomotion must arrive at the halfway stage before it arrives at the goal." Zeno's paradox is that if the object must first reach a halfway point before reaching the goal, then it only travels half the remaining distance to the goal. So the object would never actually reach the goal. But Zeno didn't know about limits. We can represent one unit as a series of smaller and smaller fractions, each fraction being one half of the previous fraction. But does the sum of the repeated halves actually add up to the total length of one? In Zeno's words, does the object ever reach the goal? To visualize this, draw a line of any length, and let it be one unit. Starting at one end of the line, move to the midpoint of the line. You have covered one half of the line, with one half remaining. Then move to the midpoint of the remaining portion of the line. You have now covered 3/4 of the line, with 1/4 remaining. Move to the midpoint of the remaining portion. Repeat this indefinitely. Do you ever reach the end of the line? The mathematical solution to the paradox, proposed by George Cantor in the 19th century, uses the limit of a convergent infinite series. In mathematical terms, we write the limit, lim, as n approaches infinity, of the sum of the function 1 over 2 to the ith power, where I goes from 1 to n. The sum is abbreviated with the Greek letter sigma. It can be shown that this infinite series converges to 1. The limit was the key to resolving this paradox. In this section, you will find limits by substituting numbers and learn when the limit of a function does not exist. First, we will review the steps to approximate limits numerically. Then we will go through each step using an example problem. Follow these 4 steps to approximate a limit using numbers. Step 1. Identify the number the independent variable, such as x, is approaching. Using limit notation, you write x with an arrow pointing to n. Step 2. Plug a number a little less than this value in for the independent variable in the function and calculate the result. Step 3. Plug a number a little more than this value in for the independent variable in the function and calculate the result. In order to observe the behavior of the function as x approaches 4, we observe the function just to the left and just to the right of that point. It is important that the function is behaving similarly on both sides of this point. Step 4. If the resulting numbers from steps 2 and 3 are very close to one another, then pick a number in between them as your approximation for the limit of the function. If the numbers from step 2 and 3 are not very close, then the limit does not exist. There are some functions that behave erratically and are an exception to this rule, but they are not common, so in general, this rule will be correct. Now, let's go through each step in detail using an example problem. Consider the limit of the rational function 10x minus 40 in the numerator divided by x squared minus 4x in the denominator as x approaches 4. Notice that when x equals 4, the denominator of the function equals 0, so the function is not defined at x equals 4. Even though the function is not defined at this point, we are able to use the limit to determine how the function behaves very close to the point. Step 1 is to identify the number that the independent variable is approaching. In this example, x is the independent variable and it is approaching 4. Before we move on to steps 2 and 3, let's address a common question. What numbers do I use? For many functions, it is effective to use numbers 0.01 below and above the value x is approaching. In some extreme cases, you will need to use numbers that are closer, but let's start here for this example. On to step 2. Since the independent variable is approaching 4, plug in a number a little less than 4 for x in the function. For this example, let's use x equals 3.99. Replace x with 3.99 throughout the function and simplify. The answer is approximately 2.51. Step 3 is just like step 2, only you plug a number a little more than 4 in for x. What value would you use? For this example, let's use 4.01. Again, evaluate the function when x equals 4.01 and simplify. This time, the answer is approximately 2.49. Step 4 is to analyze the results from step 2 and step 3 to see if they are close to each other. If so, pick a number in between them as a reasonable approximation for the limit. Steps 2 and 3 yielded estimates of 2.51 and 2.49. A reasonable approximation for the limit of this function as x approaches 4 is 2.5. In this example, the two values that resulted by evaluating x near 4 were very close to each other, 2.49 and 2.51. So it was reasonable to approximate the limit at 2.5. When the resulting values are not close to each other, try repeating steps 2 and 3 with values of x that are even closer to n, such as 3.999 and 4.001 for our example. If the resulting values are still not very close to each other, then conclude that the limit does not exist. Let's look at another example. Consider the limit of the absolute value of x divided by x as x approaches 0. Step 1. Identify the number that the independent variable is approaching. X is the independent variable and it is approaching 0. Notice the function is not defined at x equals 0 because of the x in the denominator. Before moving on to step 2, take a moment to sketch a graph of the function. Use values of x equal to -5, -3, -1, 1, 3, and 5. Viewing a graph of a function can often be very helpful in evaluating a limit of the function. What value is the function approaching as x approaches 0 from the left and from the right? Now hold that thought while we continue on to step 2. Step 2. Since x is approaching 0, plug in a number a little less than 0 for x. This will give us an idea of what the function is doing as x approaches 0 from the left. Try -0.01. Now simplify. You might be able to do this one in your head. The answer is -1. In fact, the answer is -1 for any negative value of x. Step 3. Since x is approaching 0, plug a number a little more than 0 in for x. This will give us an idea of what the function is doing as x approaches 0 from the right. Let x equal 0.01. Simplifying, the answer is 1. Similarly, the answer is 1 for any positive value of x. You now should have an idea of how the function is behaving, just to the left and just to the right of 0. Step 4 is to analyze the results from steps 2 and 3 to determine if they are close to each other. Left of 0, the function is -1, and right of 0, the function is 1. These values are not very close to each other, and they never will be. Did you see this behavior as x approaches 0 when you analyzed the graph during step 1? Because the function does not approach a particular number as x approaches 0 from the left and from the right, we say this limit does not exist. Let's do one more example. Consider the limit of x squared divided by the polynomial x squared minus x minus 2 as x approaches 2. X is the independent variable, and it is approaching 2. Repeating steps 2 and 3, the results are not very close to each other at all. And if you try values of x that are even closer to 2, you will confirm that this limit is not converging on a particular number, so the limit does not exist. At this point, you are able to approximate limits, provided they exist, by observing the behavior of the function just to the left and just to the right of the value x approaches. In this section, you will use algebra skills to solve for the actual value of the limit, once again, provided it exists. After completing this section, you will be able to 1. Find the limit of a polynomial function by plugging in the value x approaches. 2. Find the limit of a function at a vertical asymptote. And 3. Find the limit of a function with a removable discontinuity. Each situation is unique and requires a different approach. Let's review the basic steps to finding limits algebraically. First, plug the value that the independent variable approaches into the function. You do this to see if the function is defined at the point. What type of result do you get? There are three possible types to consider. First possibility, if you get a finite number, then just plugging in was good enough, and the result is the limit of the function as x approaches n. You just found the limit by the method we call plugging in. Second possibility, if you get a finite number divided by 0, then the function has a vertical asymptote at x equals n. The limit could be positive infinity, negative infinity, or it might not exist. You will use sign analysis to decide which it is. Third possibility, if you get 0 over 0 as the result, that means there is a removable discontinuity at the value x approaches. To solve, simplify the function to remove the discontinuity. Then, plug the value x approaches back into the function. We will go through an example of each situation, starting with when you can plug in. Sometimes, you can find a limit by plugging the value the independent variable approaches into the function and simplifying. This is evident when the function is defined at the plugged-in value. In other words, when you are able to plug in the value and solve for a finite number as the answer. Plugging in takes two steps. Step 1. Plug the value the independent variable is approaching into the function. Step 2. If you get a finite number after simplifying, this number is the limit. And you are done. Now for an example. Consider the limit of the polynomial function 1 plus x squared plus x cubed as x approaches negative 5. Step 1. Since the function is a polynomial and therefore defined for all values of x, just plug the value negative 5 into the function and simplify. You should get the answer negative 99. Step 2. Since you got the finite number, negative 99, when plugging in, then the limit equals negative 99. And you are done. In the last example, the function was a polynomial. You can always find the limit of a polynomial when plugging in. Now, let's look at how to find the limit of a function with a vertical asymptote. You can identify these functions when plugging in gets an answer in the form A over 0, where A is a finite number. The answer is not defined because of the division by 0. Before we go any further, though, it is important to understand the definition of a vertical asymptote. Graphically, a vertical asymptote is a vertical line that the graph of the function gets closer and closer to, but never actually reaches. Also, the function is undefined at the x value where the vertical asymptote occurs. Algebraically, a vertical asymptote occurs at a value of x when plugging the x value into the function results in a finite number divided by 0. In the function x divided by the product x minus 1 times x minus 2, the denominator equals 0 when x equals 1 or x equals negative 2. So this function has two vertical asymptotes, which is represented by vertical lines at x equals 1 and x equals 2. So this function has two vertical asymptotes, which are represented by vertical lines at x equals 1 and x equals 2. On both sides of an asymptote, the function gets closer and closer to the line, but it never actually reaches it. So can the limit of a function at a vertical asymptote be a finite number? If you said no, you are correct. The function increases in the positive or negative direction without end as it approaches the vertical asymptote. There are four steps to find the limit at a vertical asymptote. Step 1. Plug the value the independent variable is approaching into the function. Step 2. If you get a fraction with a non-zero finite number in the numerator and with 0 in the denominator, then there is a vertical asymptote at that value of x. Step 3. To find the limit at the asymptote, plug in numbers a little bit less and a little bit more than the x value of the asymptote. Step 4. There are three possible outcomes depending on the results you get in step 3. If both results of step 3 are positive numbers, then the limit is positive infinity. If both results are negative numbers, then the limit is negative infinity. If one result is positive and the other is negative, then the limit does not exist, abbreviated DNE. We will go through each step using an example. Consider the limit of the function 6x divided by the polynomial 9x squared minus 6x plus 1. As x approaches 1/3. Step 1 is to plug the value approached by the independent variable into the function. After simplifying, you should get 2 over 0. Step 2. Since the result is a finite number over 0, you know the function has a vertical asymptote at x equals 1/3. Step 3 is to plug numbers a little less and a little more than 1/3 in for x. We'll use the decimals 0.33 and 0.34. The resulting expressions from plugging in 0.33 and 0.34 simplify to 19,800 and 5,100, respectively. While they are not identical, it is important that they are both large positive numbers. This is where the sign analysis is used. You analyze the sign of the results to determine the behavior of the function. Step 4. Since both numbers are large positive numbers, the limit of this function, as x approaches 1/3, is positive infinity. That is, the limit is infinitely large. If this function had a negative sign in the numerator, which just flips the graph of the function vertically, both numbers found in step 3 would be negative, so the limit would be negative infinity. A good example of a limit that does not exist is the limit of the function 1 over x, as x approaches 0. It has a vertical asymptote at x equals 0, but the function approaches positive infinity from the right of zero and negative infinity from the left of zero, so this limit does not exist. Plug in some positive and negative values near zero for this function, and you will see. Now that you know how to handle vertical asymptotes, let's move on to the functions that have removable discontinuities. You can identify these functions when plugging in results in 0 over 0, which is not a finite number. The 0 result in the numerator and denominator are evidence the function has a removable discontinuity. A removable discontinuity is a single point that the graph of a function skips. In its current form, the function is not defined at that point. It is usually the result of the numerator and denominator of the function having a common factor, which can be canceled and removed. The function x squared minus 3x all over 2x minus 6 looks very complex, but it has a removable discontinuity. The numerator and denominator have a common factor, x minus 3. By factoring the top and bottom of the fraction and canceling the common factor, the function simplifies to x over 2. The graph of the function is a simple line with a removable continuity or hole at the point 3, 1.5. The graph of the function is a simple line with a removable discontinuity or hole. There are 4 steps to identify and remove a removable discontinuity when evaluating a limit. Step 1. Plug the value the independent variable is approaching into the function. Step 2. If you get a fraction with a 0 in the numerator and in the denominator, then there is a removable discontinuity. Step 3. To remove the discontinuity, factor the numerator and denominator of the function and simplify. Step 4. When the function is simplified, try plugging in again. The number you get is the answer to the limit. Another example. Consider the limit of x squared minus 9 all over x squared plus 3x as x approaches negative 3. Step 1 is to plug the value approached by the independent variable into the function. Plug negative 3 into the function and simplify. The result is 0 over 0. Step 2 is to identify the presence of a removable discontinuity. The result 0 over 0 at the x value means the function has a removable discontinuity at x equals negative 3. Step 3 is to factor the numerator and denominator of the function in order to simplify the function and remove the discontinuity. The numerator and denominator can be factored, and the common factor, x plus 3, can be removed. The result is x minus 3 all over x. A note on the canceled factors. Notice that the factor you canceled was x plus 3, which is what made the top and bottom 0 in the first place. Now you know why the 0 over 0 is evidence of a removable discontinuity. In fact, if you are having trouble factoring the numerator or denominator, this observation gives you a place to start when looking for a common factor. Moving on to step 4. Simplify the function by crossing out the factor, x plus 3, in the numerator and the denominator. Now plug the number x approaches, negative 3, into the simplified function. And the limit of the function as x approaches negative 3 is 2. In this unit, we covered the basics for understanding and evaluating limits for some common situations. These concepts include 1. Approximating limits. 2. Plugging in numbers to find limits. 3. Finding limits for functions that have vertical asymptotes. 4. Determining when the limit does not exist. And 5. Finding limits for functions that have removable discontinuities. Congratulations! You have completed this tutorial and are ready to move on to the next tutorial. For more audio and visual tutorials in chemistry, biology, physics, and math, go to www.rapidlearningcenter.com. Thank you.